So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review me.
Angle in trouble. Angle in trouble. Oh, yeah! It's over. It's over. The game. The game.
Your winner of the Honor of Honor.
He went through a spot of hell just to make it back. When Denny said he had never made it. And now Triple H.
Welcome to Review Away. It's John Pollock and Wei Ting. How are you, Wei?
Good.
How's your throat? You having some tea?
Yes, I am. It's my drink of choice for the time being.
From here, it looked like you were either drinking tea or your new influence is Lyoto Machida's old method.
No. That's... come on, man.
Rhymes with tea.
Oh, no.
Sorry, I'm starting this off on a bad...
That's very juvenile.
Well, this was 2002 we are talking about, a period where that was comedy. That was high-level comedy for our mid-card talents and sometimes even our main event acts.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How are you doing since Monday night? We've survived the snowstorm here in Toronto.
Yeah.
Hope all our listeners have as well.
Thawed out. Yep. Thawed. Defrosted. I am, I made it. Got my snowshoes here. Hung them up on my skis, I mean.
Cross-country
skied here.
Damn. It's tough to go up King Street on skis, but you are a man of many talents.
There's a ski lane here. We have those in Canada.
Yeah, we have now the car lanes, the bike lanes, and now the ski lanes. A lot of tax dollars, but worthwhile in the end. A little unproductive in the summer, but that's why we... swim in those lanes.
Well, you can alternatively, you can ride mooses. Mooses, it's actually...
Do you remember when we had those in 2000? Like, that was this big... every couple of years, Toronto has, an identity crisis where, hey, we're not like New York. We need something to identify ourselves as. And one year, one of our massive ideas, I have... God knows how much money was spent into these, but all these moose... were erected throughout the city of Toronto, just these giant moose statues. And I think there's one that remains in Toronto. But these were all over the place to symbolize our city of Toronto with a bunch of moose.
Right. I thought it was kind of cool, kind of neat. You didn't like it?
No, I thought they were so dumb.
Okay, what would you rather we have then?
Nothing. I know what my city is. I don't need a slogan. I don't need moose. Do you know, we had this...
This is not for you.
We had this million-dollar-plus ad campaign a few years ago where they came up. All these brilliant minds got into a room, And for months and months, they tried to come up, what is something that can be the I love New York of Toronto? What is that slogan that is going to take us to be a top regarded city? And you know what the end result was?
What?
Toronto Unlimited.
Yeah.
What does that even mean?
No, that one's not that good.
Toronto Unlimited.
There's nothing that's unlimited here. I mean, you got to pay for everything.
Everything is in moderation.
Certainly the public transit isn't unlimited. Gas isn't unlimited.
See what gas was over the past week? I saw it at 87 cents.
Almost unlimited now, but not really.
You can get it unleaded. Toronto Unleaded.
Our data plans certainly aren't unlimited.
Nope, you're capped on your download abilities.
There's nothing unlimited about this city. But come on, the Moose are just, you know.
Can't use the TTC unlimited.
I just said that.
Cuts off? Oh, I wasn't listening. My next line.
The Moose were just, you know, a bit of decoration for the city to add some tourism. I mean, maybe not for you. Maybe not for you, but for the out-of-towner from Georgetown or something, you know?
You know why there wasn't a Moose on every corner?
Okay, go ahead.
Limited supply.
Right.
The worst start to our show.
No, this is good.
You know, do you know our frequent caller on The Lost Sunday Night, Brian from Long Island?
Yes.
I love that guy. Like, just a classic Long Island accent. He always calls it, always a nice guy. He tried very valiantly to get on the show last Sunday night because he attended the Rumble. Called in once. We went to him. He was not there. He called a second time. We tried to go to him again. He's not there.
What?
I didn't know what was going on.
No, like, two strikes in your
ass. That was it. So he called a third time, and I felt really bad for Brian. I said, Brian.
Why wasn't he there? What was his excuse?
I don't know. I don't know. He said, he's like, I don't know what's happening on my end. I was like, yeah, Brian, you're in a car right now coming home from the Rumble. You get home safely, and let's just put it to bed for the week. And he's like, hey, Pollock. I'm not going to try and do his accent. I can't do Long Island. But
hey, Pollock, yo.
That's not what he sounds like at all. He's... I don't know what he sounds like, but my God, he loved our review last week. And I didn't know what was so special about last week's review, but a lot of people enjoyed last week's review. So I feel a sense of...
I don't even remember last week's review.
The
95 one, yeah.
The 95 Rumble.
Hey, Pollock, I really liked the review last week.
Well, he didn't pronounce my name like that. That would be offensive to
I don't even know what that was. It was like a
Polish
sort of Italian.
That's a derogatory remark for Polish people. I've heard it many a time.
Okay.
My homeroom teacher used to say my last name like that and then asked if I was Polish.
Polak. Yo, Polak.
No, just because my name sounds like that does not mean I am Polish. Like, what a strange connection that your name sounds like... a nationality, that must be what your nationality is. Like, hey, Joe Merkin, are you American?
Joe Merkin.
I don't know. They're a bad country to pick one for, but I think any other country I'd picked, I would be accused of being offensive. So.
So I would be way Chinese?
Yeah, if you were way...
You know, but sometimes you meet white people that are named white. For a last name, and you meet black people with the last name Black. So it would be kind of like that. Hey, yeah.
Are you Black?
That's not my last name. We do know a Black, though.
He's not Black.
He's a white guy, yeah.
This is... Maybe that would be easier for people if instead of...
Yeah.
Just trying to... Instead of names...
Yeah.
We were just called by identification.
Sean White.
Like Asian wrestling.
Way Asian. Yeah, exactly.
Way Asian. I could be... What was the comment that someone wrote on Twitter last week? Was if John Pollock was born in a different century, he would have been burned at the stake.
Oh, that's...
for my memory trick.
That's right.
Wait a minute, you retweeted that. That's how I saw it.
That's actually a compliment. It's a backwards compliment.
Sure.
Yeah.
I would be dead in another century. I wouldn't be allowed to live
because you're so talented.
I don't know about that.
Okay.
Are you excited for the 2002 Royal Rumble?
You know I am.
Who do you think is going to win this year?
2002?
We should do a pool.
Okay. our choices are The Godfather and Triple H.
We should actually do that because some people for their Royal Rumble pool, it's simply, you know, however many people. Say there's three people in a pool.
Yeah.
And you just draw numbers randomly. And whichever number corresponds with the entrant is who wins. Yeah. We could completely do that for an old Royal Rumble. Unless you believe I have a memory of entrants from past Rumbles.
Well, so what do you mean?
The week before, I'm saying.
Yeah.
We could pick, say...
just random numbers.
Random numbers. Okay. And see who wins it. Like, I could not tell you off the top of my head right now what number Triple H was in 2002.
I mean, then you might as well just play dice, you know? It's just like... there's no skill involved in that.
Well, you're picking a number from a strategic placement in the Rumble that you think will win it.
Oh, okay. You know, I mean, I feel like... Gotcha, okay. So it's basically trying to remember who came out when.
I already think this pool idea is not a great one.
Yeah, I think it's...
We'll revisit it next year when we go back to reviewing some Rumbles. But January the 20th, 2002, in Atlanta, GA, the Phillips Arena, it was home to the 2002 Royal Rumble. So we're going to chat about this entire show. And it started off with a retrospective video of past Rumble winners and big moments, including 1995, Shawn Michaels winning the 1995 Royal Rumble.
That was a big moment.
This was the year, if you remember, in 2001, they had brought out the Honky Tonk Man as a surprise entrant. This year, they announced the surprise entrance ahead of time, I guess feeling that these might be some little hooks for the Rumble to draw people in. And they announced that ahead of time, Goldust, The Godfather, and Mr. Perfect would all be returning in this match.
Yeah, I would say, really, you only have one big surprise there. The other two, they're just sort of rebranded gimmicks of guys that are already on the roster.
Yeah, Mr. Perfect was, at this point, it was, if you remember, Jimmy Hart's promotion, the XWF, had just launched in late 2001, and Mr. Perfect was one of their key stars, and the WWF scooped him up. Still in combat mode, even after WCW had gone away. So that was part of the reasoning for grabbing Perfect. And then Godfather and Goldust were, I guess, available.
Venus, you mean? Or was Goldust a new...
Val Venus was also back in this Rumble. Was he one of the announced?
I think so, wasn't he?
Well.
They were all, like, right-to-censor guys that were coming back, weren't they? Okay, but, yeah, I guess Goldust, too.
The theme song. Did you watch this on the network?
Yes.
Well, then the theme song was uninteresting production music.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, it was Cocky by Kid Rock.
Right.
Not a song that you listen to and think pro wrestling videos, pro wrestling hype videos.
I don't know if there are any songs I listen to and think pro wrestling hype video.
But some lend themselves more than others. Cocky by Kid Rock would not be one of the songs that I would listen to and think, yeah, this would be great for our final video right before the Royal Rumble.
I don't think it's any worse than, you know, U2.
I guess it's all in how they are utilized. Kid Rock, a big favorite amongst the WWF production crew. Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler are the announcers for the show. This was pre-split. This was one of the last pay-per-views together before they would split up the rosters later in March. And we kicked off with Taz and Spike Dudley, this underdog tag team defending the tag titles against the Dudley Boys with Stacy Keibler in their corner. Spike was in a neck brace after they had attacked Spike on SmackDown and gave him a 3D on a car.
Mm-hmm.
But he has had 3 days to heal since then and has the requisite neck brace, which was quickly torn off by Bubba as they work over the neck of Spike. Ross indicates that Bubba delivers a Dick Murdoch-like brainbuster onto Spike. 2 weeks in a row of Dick Murdoch.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Spike then hits the Dudley Dog to Bubba. A move I always thought was... I always thought the Dudley Dong, whenever he would hit this, that was always what it sounded like when Jim Ross would call this thing, the Dudley Dog. I don't even know what that means. Like, the Dudleys have a pet dog, and this is how it's immortalized through this neckbreaker maneuver that used to be an acid drop.
Oh, it's a bulldog.
It's more a face buster, really, like a cutter.
Well, it looks like a bulldog.
Mm.
That's why they call it that.
You think they couldn't have gotten away with it with acid drop? Was that too risque for WWF programming in 2002?
I guess they thought it was.
Guess Spike was not the the acid-dropping type character any longer. The referee missed a tag to Taz as the Dudleys hit this high flapjack to Spike. Devon missed a headbutt. They eventually got the hot tag with Taz coming in, suplexing both Dudleys. There's a running boot to the face, another Dudley dong, and then Stacy gets on the apron. Taz applies the Taz mission to Stacy, a sign of the times in 2002. Devon attacks from behind and then blocks the Dudley dog, sending Spike all the way to the floor. This poor man, I would love to know how he feels today. Because this was every notable match for Spike Dudley, taking stuff like this. Devon runs and misses Taz into the corner. Taz's mission is locked on, and Devon taps out at 5 minutes and 6 seconds. Mm-hmm. I always felt Taz and Spike were they were a fun tag team for the very short amount of time they were together. And fun openings match, 5 minutes. Way better than New Age Outlaws and the Ascension last weekend.
No, I really don't recall these two even teaming up, much less being champions. But, I mean, perhaps the only tag team combo where Taz can seem like the larger person in the team. I don't know. Were they fun? I've always pictured Taz as more of a, to me, not so much an underdog. I've always pictured him more as, you know, a guy who can actually be a tough physical monster who can throw people around.
Oh, he did a lot of that in this. Tossing the Dudleys around with suplexes. Team did not last long, but I enjoyed it for the brief time they were around. They showed a highlight from Raw on Monday with Regal attacking Edge and RVD with brass knuckles, which was part of his gimmick at the time. Edge then responding with chair shots on SmackDown to Regal. And then later Nick Patrick as well taking a chair shot. So trying to give an edge to the character of Adam Copeland. Lillian Garcia's in the back interviewing Edge. My goodness, this man was big on enunciating words.
Yeah.
He had a real issue with this.
He was, this babyface Edge, I thought, was a little too, he tended to overact a lot.
Let me tell you something, Lillian. I've got the chair, and the chair is going to hit William Regal.
Yeah, this was, a tough transition for Edge, I thought. That took years for him to fully complete, where he went from the fun, kind of pretty boy heel tag team that people really got into with all the tag matches with Edge and Christian, the Dudleys and Hardys. But now they broke them off. He was a singles babyface. And it was always the comment that everyone always used was with Edge, people liked him as a babyface but didn't love him. They disliked him as a heel but never hated him as a heel.
Mm-hmm.
And then it wasn't until the Matt Hardy program where they had a strong emotion towards Edge. Mm-hmm. And between 2002 and 2006, this guy had lots of good matches, but he was in this role that he was not breaking through to the top main event picture, which they saw him as eventually ascending to. Edge and Regal for the Intercontinental title. This was the second of three straight pay-per-views that these two men would have singles matches. For the Intercontinental title, with Edge defending the title, Nick Patrick searches around the ring for brass knuckles, and then Edge comes out to his Rob Zombie theme. So, certain music that is covered here on the network and others that would not be. I know for a lot of home videos, they took out the Rob Zombie theme that he used for about a year. Nick Patrick does search the tights of William Regal, finding brass knuckles after Jerry Lawler calls Nick Patrick a pervert. Regal used this half Nelson suplex a number of times, the first one turning him in midair and always going for the pinfall where he would put that forearm right in the face of his opponent. I always liked that added touch with Regal. Edge hit a back body drop as Regal held on to these double underhooks and then rolled through, hitting a double underhook suplex. Edge then stopped Regal on the outside of the apron, hitting a DDT where they brought up his injured nose. He had had this sinus issue where he was constantly getting these bleeding noses during matches that he legitimately had to have all these operations on and worked it into the story of the match. Regal came out of the corner, and they appeared to crack heads here as they went down. It was a very ugly collision of heads. Regal then back to that half Nelson suplex, Edge landing on his back. Then he went for an implant DDT that he called the Edgecution at the time, working that word edge into just about everything he did. It is blocked. Regal applies an STF, Edge getting the rope break reversed and applied his own STF. Then there is a suplex off the top, which gets stopped. Edge hits a top rope spinning heel kick, and then Regal has another pair of brass knucks that Nick Patrick did not find, and Edge spears both Patrick and Regal, and while the referee is out, Regal clocks Edge with the knuckles and gets the pin and wins the title, his first IC title win, at 9 minutes and 44 seconds.
Mm-hmm. I think Regal, you know, he's got a style that's really unique that you still don't really see today. And it's kind of hard to appreciate unless you kind of know the intricacies of what's going on. I don't personally consider myself one of these people, but, I mean, I could still appreciate, you know, one of his matches.
It was a stumbling block for Regal. I always like different styles. I think it makes your roster, it just creates so many more interesting scenarios when you have guys working so many different styles, but that's not always been the MO of the company, to have vastly different in-ring styles. And Regal could, and with the right guys, they would be incredible matches, but didn't always connect with the key people that were in charge of the show.
At one point, somebody in the crowd had a sign that he held up, and I saw security confiscate the sign. And I didn't see what the sign read, so I rewound it. And what did the sign say?
Oh, no.
You suck.
Really?
Yeah. They took that away. They couldn't have that.
Wow. WWE, where freedom of expression is always encouraged, unless you say a man sucks. Trish Stratus. Oh, first we had Michael Cole in the aisle interview Regal. He says that he has been given the power of the punch, and he looks up to the sky and says, "Thank you." And we cut to Jim Ross, who just dismisses the notion that the good Lord had anything to do with this finish. I love this. Regal just looking up into the sky, into the heavens. Trish Stratus and Jazz were next for the women's title, with Trish defending the championship and Jacqueline as the referee. And Jazz had attacked Stratus on SmackDown and shut this giant kind of equipment case on Stratus's left hand, so it is taped up for this match. God, I'm certainly learning these many years later that the SmackDown before the pay-per-view, that was when you shot the big injury angles, whether it was breaking necks on cars, breaking hands. That's what sets up the revenge 3 days later.
Mm.
All this time, I thought it would be much longer builds for this. But no, 3 days was the typical amount of time you needed for a major injury to be digested by the crowd.
Yeah, that's kind of silly.
These poor women. One of the biggest problems at this time was that we were coming off the era of the puppies era of women's wrestling, where the crowd would invariably always revert to these puppies chants. But this was when the women were starting to take a bit of a step forward when it came to their in-ring. This was the infancy stage. But my God, did they have no assistance from Jerry Lawler, who was just enamored with Trish Stratus and her purple puppies.
Jazz with more experience than Trish. Oh, no! And a big splash. Run the purple puppies and a near fall.
Hey, it's my line. Right on the purple puppies.
Mm-hmm. They constantly brought up for us to be aware of. And Ross confirming purple puppies indeed. As the match began, Trish had her first match of the night against her coat, as this jacket got tangled in her arms, and this was a hell of a struggle. More than any you would see during the actual 4-minute match between these two, but somehow was able to get this jacket off. But this was second only to Lex Luger taking that shirt off during that backstage promo. Do you remember? Mm-mm. Lex Luger wrestles a shirt? A clip you must look up.
Okay.
We had Chance of Puppies. The women here just going back and forth. Jazz goes after the bad hand of Trish, wraps it around the bottom rope, and then Jazz and Jacqueline get into an argument, and there is a shove by Jackie, and Jazz then blocks a roll-up, grabs the legs of Stratus for a roll-up, and Jacqueline just, deer in the headlights, stares at this pinfall, not knowing what to do, and then counts two before Trish kicks out.
It was because they explained that it was because she thought that she caused the pinfall.
Yeah, this was, I guess maybe she had been watching Shawn Michaels officiate that Bret Hart Undertaker SummerSlam match. Trish then hits the Stratisfaction, Jazz kicks out, and then hits a DDT. Trish then gets her boot up in the corner, hits a face buster, and gets the pin. 3 minutes and 44 seconds, and Lawler offers to nurse Trish back to health. Very quick match.
Yeah,
I don't have a whole lot to say. The finish was very much out of nowhere, and you would see a lot more between these two in the year to come.
It was short, but I thought a pretty high-paced match, especially for a women's division at the time. I think Jazz is just an awesome worker. Very clean, very stiff-looking offense. And
She was my favorite female in the company in 2002 and 3. Yeah. I thought she was so underrated and so forgotten during that time frame.
And she just added a really aggressive style that I don't think the division had at the time.
Yeah, I always thought the addition of Jazz and Fit Finlay were the two keys to that division, and a lot of women that were just eager to change the perception of women's wrestling in the company, and Jazz, a huge part of that. Ric Flair arrives at the arena with his daughter Megan and Reed, and Jonathan Coachman wants to interview him. Flair has no time for this, just said, good night. We got a video on the history of Ric Flair and Vince McMahon going back to Flair's debut the night after the Survivor Series. This also, I love these video pieces where you just get little snippets of all the angles they've done on TV. This featured Vince dressing up as Ric Flair, including wearing a wig along with his robe, blasting Ric Flair with a pipe, with Flair bleeding all over a conveniently worn white shirt, and a shot of Chris Jericho wearing these chessboard spandex pants that just looked completely horrendous no matter what year that we are talking about. This was something out of 1975 in 2002. This man dressed horrendously in 2002.
Yeah, I thought so. I thought Vince was just particularly hilarious in this recap. Just all his facial expressions. He's just so funny.
This was Vince at his finest maybe as a performer during 99 to 2002.
He's
the man
so
was
cartoony
just,
and just over the top. You know, Flair decks him, and then Vince just goes cross-eyed on the floor. That whole ear-tugging, bewildered face that I think we all see in all those highlight packages. He's very funny.
The grabbing of the ear when Ric Flair came out.
Yeah.
You know, the history books will say that Vince McMahon has only wrestled God at one WWE pay-per-view. But the way this crowd at the Phillips Arena in Atlanta treated Ric Flair when he came out, they will tell you he wrestled God twice. Mm-hmm. Ric Flair came out, and my God, was this man treated as the second coming. They stood up. They were applauding this legend. This was Ric Flair, maybe his finest reception, at least at that time period. I mean, you can go back to the retirement in 2008. Outside of that time period, holy Christ, was Ric Flair just so revered in this early portion of his return to the WWF.
Well, this was his return to the...
And in Atlanta, yeah.
His return to the WWF in ring. He had come back after the Survivor Series.
Yeah, hadn't done any matches up until this point. And then out came Vince McMahon. And I'll defer to the comment made by Jerry Lawler.
Holy mackerel, JR!
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I guess we have a few contenders here.
We have more than one, but Vince McMahon high in the running for the Scott Putski Award, which will be given out at the end of this show. But Vince McMahon, at the age of 56, I can only imagine that this man... Remember when you would play basketball and you would need to buy that pump and put the needle in the ball and just... I imagine that a similar contraption was devised maybe by IcoPro back in the day that Vince still had a patent on.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God, did this man come out just looking... I was speechless, even having seen this match many times in the past.
JR describes both men as former WWF champions, both former...
This was outrageous.
Royal Rumble winners.
Both true.
There's just something wrong when you have Vince McMahon and Ric Flair
on equal footing.
Yeah.
So, right before the bell rings, you see the shot on Ric Flair, and he just mouths the words, fuck you, to Vince. As we get set, Ric Flair's two children are ringside with a camera. They are going to document this match. Vince starts posing and chops Flair, and then Flair comes back with his own chops. Flair, in an effort to recapture some of his youth, went for the Ric Flair, Ray Stevens bump into the corner, going for the flip over, but sadly could not quite make it right over. It was a tumble over head over ass. And then Vince attacks him. They go to the floor. They had these keep off signs, and Vince did not keep off them. He just used them on Flair. They used a trash can. Flair is busted open from this trash can, and suddenly we have Ric Flair bleeding from the forehead as they are brawling right up against the fans.
Mm-hmm.
Watching this and just how close they were to these fans, it is no wonder that blood is no longer a part of this promotion. Mm-hmm. I mean, this just seems, to the untrained eye that does not watch wrestling for a long period of history, this just looks grotesque.
Yeah.
You are brawling into people, bleeding, and it's Ric Flair. Vince scoop slams Flair and then steals Megan's camera and takes a selfie. Yeah. In 2002.
I know, this was way before Instagram.
My God, this was, I mean, you'd need to go to Blacks and get this this photo, and then you would have to go on your scanner, and then you would have to email it to all your friends because mm-hmm. you wouldn't have a service to share photos to the world.
Yeah.
I guess you could upload it to WWF.com at the time. Very retroactive technology here mm-hmm. in 2002. Vince would then continue with the heat and goes after the left knee of Flair, wraps it around the post. Vince then applied a figure four. Flair says, Ross says that this would ruin Flair's entire professional life if he was forced to submit to the figure four applied by Vince McMahon. But Flair turns it over as the crowd roars in approval. Vince goes to the floor, gets his pipe at ringside. Ross says it's legal, but it's not very damn ethical to use a pipe in this kind of a match. Flair hits a low blow, preventing the pipe shot, and then Flair chops him on the floor, cracks Vince with a monitor to the head, and then Flair starts yelling into the monitor as though he was expecting a response, and then picked up the other monitor so that he could watch the replay of his monitor shot to Vince.
That was weird. I don't know what the hell they were planning.
This was Kevin Dunn, some ambitious directing on his part.
Some art.
You're going to look in and watch your own work, and we're going to go over the shoulder. But this did not come across as well. So now Vince is busted open. We have two men over the age of 50 bleeding all over one another. Then in one of the most disgusting displays of human interaction, Ric Flair pulls up bloody Vince McMahon in front of his children and in front of his two kids, bites Vince's bloody forehead as he's bleeding for his children to take a photo.
Gross,
the most irresponsible photo op I have ever seen. This was gross. I turned my head. I'm too old, Way. I don't want blood in wrestling. This was my confirmation point. Disgusting.
Well, I think there was a lot less research going on about the dangers of, you know, two open wounds and blood.
Really? Because I was alive in 2002, and I was very much aware of blood transfusion at this time, even in this kind of environment. Well, this was disgusting.
Well, you're way ahead of the curve then, John.
I guess so. Flair hits him with a low blow, grabs the pipe and cracks Vince in the head and applies the figure four. And at 14 minutes and 53 seconds, Vince McMahon furiously not only taps, he double taps, ending the match. And Ric Flair prevails in Atlanta, and this crowd is ecstatic. Ric Flair, their savior, has returned to the WWF and conquered Vince McMahon.
I thought this was a fun little match. It, by no means a technical classic, but I thought it was a great display of what personality and, you know, great selling by Ric Flair can accomplish. You know, now that they don't really occur anymore, I kind of have a new appreciation for these Vince McMahon matches. I just find them so...
They're intricately booked, and they are given shortcuts that are going to get maximum reaction from minimal work.
Yeah, and I just find the guy so entertaining, you know. Even though he can't really pull off, you know, a suplex, it's just everything he does in between all his moves that I think he's just so great.
I think I've always felt the style of Vince McMahon is perfect for the kid. This guy should be a horrible pro wrestler.
Yep.
He should be terrible. He is a 56-year-old man at this time that is not a wrestler.
He uses shortcuts to, you know, get the upper hand.
I would never want to see this man hit a dragon screw leg whip. It should never be even ventured into. Michael Cole is with Nick Patrick to discuss the footage showing of William Regal using brass knuckles. But before he can discuss this, Stephanie walks in. She had just returned to television after a lengthy month and a half away after the end of the invasion and the alliance was vanquished forever. Kind of, I guess, very similar to this past year's Survivor Series, disappearing and already back on TV in January. So Stephanie walks in, sending Nick Patrick on his merry way, and says beating Ric Flair just gave that the beating that Flair just gave Vince is nothing compared to what Triple H is going to do in the Royal Rumble, as he as she runs through all of the names that Hunter is going to go through. So this was an awkward point where Stephanie was one of your top heels on television, but Hunter was a solid babyface, but the two were still married, as we would have to work towards the official television breakup of Triple H and Stephanie at this point. But Steve Austin, who was named by Stephanie, appears in the background, walks up behind Stephanie, and yells, "What?" And January 20th, 2002, we may have been at the zenith point of the "What" movement.
Over the top rope! 29 people! You're going to kick Deborah's ass! What? Go ahead, talk! What? What?
A horrendous historical period that is still felt to this day in pro wrestling.
Yeah, it was cool at the time.
People love this. Stephanie ends up yelling and running off at all the "what" chants, and we had Austin run through all of these words, constantly cutting to fans chanting "what" to fan signs, and at the height of his delivery, grabbing Michael Cole by the neck and basically wringing his neck to emphasize his point. But what was the word of the day in WWF programming in 2002 at this point?
Mm-hmm.
Even made a shirt out of it.
Yeah.
Which I always remember when Austin would leave, they photoshopped the shirt into "Y" with Austin's face on it.
Oh, did they do that?
They did it on a magazine cover. It was instead of "what," it was "why." Why, Steve? Next up was a video for the WWF title match. Rock defeated Booker T to get this title shot on SmackDown. And watching these packages was felt like the number one show. Jericho, at this point, was very much being positioned as kind of this comedy heel champion. And then on the final show before this Rumble, I always remember this promo where he basically told Rock, "Shut up, I'm not a joke, and I'm sick of your catchphrases." And Rock gave him these words that he is taking him very seriously, and he doesn't view Chris Jericho as a joke. And 17-year-old me really thought that this was a real effort to take Chris Jericho to the next level with this title. And I would be sorely mistaken in the months to follow going into WrestleMania 18. But at this time, I really thought that Chris Jericho was going to get the real main event treatment going into WrestleMania, even if he was going to drop that title. But at this point, what did you feel about Chris Jericho? He was the dark horse to win the title in December. Did you feel that he was going to get that ascension?
I feel that, you know, obviously Jericho is very talented, but even after winning the title, I just felt like him being champ, he still felt a far step lower than, you know, the rest of the top stars in the company at the time. And I don't know if you know, chalk that up due to size or what, but he just didn't really feel, you know, on par with a Rock Austin, Triple H, or maybe even in Kurt Angle.
Yeah, I think that with Austin and Rock, they were these two templates of guys that got over and did at later points incorporate comedy in, and that became the idea of their main event talent, you sprinkle in that comedy. Whereas Jericho and Angle were two examples of guys that they used a lot of comedy at their base, especially Angle, and it was harder for them to get into that top role where I think you need to dial back the comedy significantly. And with Jericho, I think he was really battling that at this point, where he still was not – he was perceived as this pesky heel that wasn't on par with the major guys at the time, your Hunters, your Austins, your Takers.
Yeah.
At that time. Jericho and Rock for the WWF title. Rock's reaction was just insane when he walked out here. The loudest of the show so far. And it's crazy when you look back at 2002, Way, and after that Hogan match at WrestleMania, I mean, that was really the point where he was starting to phase out as a full-time performer. This guy was 29 years old at this time, and he had already reached this level where he was starting to phase out as your every week kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
That's insane.
Yeah.
29 years old he was in 2002. I was very much looking forward to this match. They had had a singles match at the prior year's No Mercy, which I thought was a great match. Jericho is trash-talking him at the start of the match. He gets into his face and then puts his hand up in Rock's face and does the bring it signal as they start the match. Jericho has the advantage, takes the turnbuckle pad off. Rock then counters the walls of Jericho, crowd solidly behind the Rock. Lawler is able to incorporate the lyrics to Cocky by Kid Rock to describe Jericho's attitude that it's not being cocky if you back it up. Long rear chinlock spot by Jericho. Jericho gets crotched on the top turnbuckle. Rock then hits a superplex. Jericho then comes back with a facebuster and a lion salt, then hits a second one but can only get a two count on Rock. Rock catches him off the turnbuckle with a dropkick attempt, applies the sharpshooter, and then Lance Storm runs down to distract Earl Hebner, and then behind the referee's back, Christian runs in, gets fought off by Rock, and it leads to Jericho hitting a rock bottom for a near fall, and Lance and Christian would make their way to the back. I totally forgot about these two run-ins at the time, and I wonder if this was just a one-off or a direction they were teasing with these guys being aligned with Chris Jericho at the time. Mm-hmm. On top, Rock is laying down. Jericho goes for the people's elbow, but Rock stops it with a kip up and then tosses Jericho over the top to the floor. Rock then clears the announce desk as Jim Ross is pleading, "We've got to work here, Rock." Jericho then puts him on the Spanish table, taking into account Jim Ross's concerns. And then Rock reverses, hits a rock bottom through the Spanish announce desk, and gets on top of it, rolls Jericho into the ring, gets another near fall. Jericho blocks another rock bottom, goes for the walls, and gets it, but Rock gets the rope break. And then Jericho ducks a flying forearm, and Rock takes out Earl Hebner, allowing Jericho to hit a belt shot. Nick Patrick runs in, counts two. Rock then gets up, DDT, Patrick will no longer count, and it leads to Rock hitting a rock bottom to Nick Patrick. There's a spinebuster, a people's elbow to Jericho, the referee is still out, Rock gets up, and Jericho hits a low blow, sends Rock into the exposed turnbuckle, and then on top of it, uses the rope for leverage as Jericho pins the Rock at 18 minutes and 50 seconds, a finish that heavily was designed to more or less protect the Rock and keep the title on Jericho. What did you think of the match?
I thought it was a very good match. Crowd was very loud. I thought the finish was executed very well, as you'd expect from Jericho and the Rock.
Yeah, crowd very much into it. I didn't think their best singles match that they had together, but a very good WWF title match at the time. Rock asks how Jericho is possibly going to sleep tonight, winning in the fashion of which he did. And then we went to WWF New York, where Shawn Michaels, endearing himself to the New York audience, wearing a cowboy hat, a belt buckle, and a Texas dress shirt.
Mm-hmm.
This man.
And
better dressed than most Michaels appearances, but still the odd man out in this bar in New York.
And talking about George Bush.
Yeah. Puts over Vince versus Flair, and then quotes President Bush when picking a Rumble winner, saying, "You don't mess with Texas." and picking Steve Austin and The Undertaker. I guess going with co-winners this year is Shawn Michaels. So really planting the flag in the soil with his pick. And then we went to a video for the Rumble with our production music to get us set for the Rumble match. And Howard Finkel outlined the rules of the Rumble. And then drawing number one was Rikishi, and number two was Goldust, getting the nostalgia pop for his return to television after... This would be his return after his brief WCW run when he left for there in 1999. Third out, the Big Boss Man. Fourth was Bradshaw. And this was when we saw the first elimination with Rikishi eliminating the Big Boss Man. Fifth out was Lance Storm. And Goldust lifted Storm and went to drop him throat first on the top rope. Totally missed the rope, and Lance just plummeted down onto the mat. Al Snow is in number sixth. This was when Lance Storm was murdered with a clothesline from hell from Bradshaw. Not a great night so far for Lance Storm in the Rumble. Number seven was Billy Gunn. And Snow and Storm are fighting on the outside of the apron with Al Snow kicking Storm. And that was the end of Lance Storm's evening. Gunn then eliminated Bradshaw from behind. Number eight, the first big name of the Rumble, The Undertaker, who, even though was a heel by this point, treated like a babyface, comes in, choke slams Goldust right over the top to the floor, then tosses out Al Snow, clotheslines Rikishi out, and then tosses out Billy Gunn, and Undertaker is all alone in the ring. This was short hair, Mark Calloway.
Mm-hmm.
What did you think of this heel run at the time for The Undertaker? It was brief.
Yeah, it was completely different. Well, he had done the biker thing earlier, but this is sort of the, what is it, Big Evil era.
Yeah, this was a Booger Red era.
Yeah, right. You know, I mean, it was him trying to recreate his character under a new realistic sense. And obviously, you know, history won't really look back on it as his greatest creation. But I think he took elements from this time and he still incorporated it into his later years, in particular his in-ring style.
And in the video right before the Rumble, they showed the turn by The Undertaker, I believe, or maybe it was something else, but the big turn, the guy that they just relied on when they had to turn a big guy heel, beat the shit out of Jim Ross, which is what The Undertaker did on television.
Mm-hmm.
Just make them hate him through JR. So with Taker alone in the ring, Matt Hardy came out number 9, followed by Jeff number 10 with Lita in their corner. Now at this point, this was after the Hardys had done the tease of the breakup and done their singles match the prior month, in a pay-per-view match that really bombed. The crowd did not take to the Hardy versus Hardy match or feud, and they just reacted by taking both off television for a number of weeks and then coming back here at the Royal Rumble. And as Jeff came in after Matt, they both attacked The Undertaker. They hugged, and it was the shower scene from Dallas. The breakup never happened. They were just back to being a team. They went for a poetry in motion, and Taker caught Jeff and sent him right out to the floor and then hit a last ride to Matt and then tossed him out. Mm. Welcome back, Hardys. Then number 11 was Maven, who comes out, and Ross and Lawler indicate he has zero chance against The Undertaker. Maven comes in. He is scared. He's backing off from The Undertaker. But then the Hardys return, attacking The Undertaker, who sends them to the floor. And then as Taker is looking down at the Hardys on the floor in one of the more well-remembered eliminations in Rumble history, Maven drop kicks The Undertaker from behind, and Undertaker is eliminated, this being punctuated by a great call from Jim Ross as The Undertaker is dumped out of the Rumble. A genuine surprise when this happened in 2002.
This was a really, you know, ballsy, unique move to even book, and certainly the highlight, the lone highlight of Maven's professional wrestling career. The reactions after this happened were just fantastic from both Taker himself, just looking stunned at the ramp, not even turning back into the ring. And then Maven, first of all, celebrating, and then realizing what exactly he had just done. The look of just complete fear as Taker comes in and destroys him.
Now, Maven would become a footnote in WWE history, and I think we could agree this was the peak moment of his career. But when he came off Tough Enough, I mean, this guy was over on television. I mean, there were a lot of people that watched Tough Enough, and this guy got a pretty good reaction at the time. So it's not like this guy was a complete geek at this point. He would ascend into that or descend. And then the following year's Rumble, they basically did a playoff of the same spot where Taker no-sold the dropkick and tossed Maven out. But in 2002, Taker would return, attack Maven, tossed him to the floor, just killing him with this chair shot to the head. This chair, unusable ever again after this shot to Maven's skull. Then they would go back to the ring, and Taker would actually eliminate Maven, throwing him over the top rope. And that would be it for Maven's 2002 Rumble, but a spot that was the best possible scenario for Maven that he could have ventured for this year. Number 12, following all of that, was Scotty Too Hotty. And he comes out, and at this point, we're still focused on Taker attacking Maven, taking him out through the crowd, up to the concession area, fans legitimately going insane and needing to be held back. And in maybe the funniest moment involving The Undertaker, in mid-beatdown, taking a mouthful of popcorn and eating it over top of Maven. Christian was out 13th. 14th was DDP, his one Rumble appearance until this past year's. Scotty hits the worm to Christian, and then DDP throws Scotty out. Number 15 was Chuck Palumbo, as he had now teamed up with Billy. And JR described Chucky, it's yucky. 16th was the Godfather, who has now gone legit, running an escort service, and keeps running to the bat, bringing out more and more women. The cameras were on the women as Christian and Chuck eliminated DDP, which pretty much summed up DDP's entire run. No one noticed. Number 17 was Albert, who tries to eliminate the Godfather, but Christian and Chuck dump Albert to the floor. Godfather misses the hoe train, and Christian and Chuck clothesline Godfather out. 18th was Perry Saturn. Number 19, Steve Austin. Huge reaction coming out. And this was our next clear-out spot as Austin eliminated Christian, Chucky, and Perry Saturn. He's alone in the ring and then stuns Christian, eliminates him a second time, and does the exact same to Chuck. So double eliminations for those two this year.
This little bit was just so great where he just clears the ring upon entering and then realizes, oh, I still have all this time. Why not just bring these guys back in and attack him somewhere?
Do it again.
Just what a great character.
And Christian, the trivia note, the guy who's credited with coming up with the what chant.
Oh, wow.
From a voicemail he left on Austin's, I guess, answering machine at the time.
Okay.
I'm sure it was like Pamela Anderson's voicemail.
Yeah.
Number 20, Val Venus. And all I've got to say is that it really could have been, if it was a less competitive year, Val Venus may have been the Putski winner. The baby oil really put it over, but in a year that produced Vince McMahon and a later entrant, tough year for Val Venus. Stiff competition.
Nominated, though.
Nomination. Yeah. He is duly noted for his efforts. Huge what chance for just everything Austin did here. Just nuts. Number 21 was Test, who misses a boot to Austin and hits Venus, and then Austin eliminates Venus and then tosses Test out. Austin again alone in the ring, and number 22 is Triple H, who comes out. I've never seen a condominium move, but if it did, it would have this physique. That's how big this man was.
Okay.
Like, he had, these were not arms. These were like separate wings of an office building that he had protruding out of his chest and his torso with his legs. This guy was massive.
He was spending a lot of time working hard in rehab.
I guess when you don't have to make all those towns, you can just work out like a madman.
Yeah, he showed back up here, and I mean, I think we all just realized how this was a different Triple H. Wasn't really the the small guy. I mean, not that he was small before, but he was sort of a more light, more agile.
This guy was like 30 pounds heavier than when he went out with that quad injury at this point in 2002. And with all due respect to the Hurricane and RVD, who would show up later, I think we can announce the winner here. And this is a Hunter versus Vince kind of year. And which... Who gets the big win this year?
I think it's only appropriate that we give it to the guy whose pay-per-view this is built after. That is Triple H.
Triple H, the Scott Putski Award winner, the official winner, can go down in the record books for 2002 and the Royal Rumble. Hunter is out, so obviously a big, big stare down with Austin and Hunter, the two big favorites in the Rumble this year. They start fighting. Ross did a great job just building up this showdown. They come to blows. The next entrant is the Hurricane, who comes in for a comedy spot where he teases a double choke slam to Austin and Hunter, and they immediately just toss him out with a double beel, and then they go right back to attacking back and forth. Farouk is out number 24th with Austin stunning him and then Hunter clotheslining Farouk to the floor. Number 25, Mr. Perfect. The best surprise, or the best reaction of the, I guess, nostalgia entrance in the Rumble. Mr. Perfect came out looking very good.
Yeah. It's funny because all those years he was, it's not like he wasn't wrestling, he was in WCW, but it's just not the same. Without the gimmick, without the music, you know, he comes back here.
And probably some motivation, let's be honest.
Yeah, I mean, definitely.
Hennig was a guy that had an on and off switch.
Sure.
And it was on this particular night, and it was off for a lot of the time in WCW.
Mm-hmm.
He came out, and I was surprised at just how well they positioned this guy in the Rumble. This guy would be there till the final four. Final three, you're right. He was competitive with all the top guys. The top guys sold for him. You watch this, and you totally thought this guy is going to get a run out of this.
To me, that was really the most memorable part about this Rumble was the fact that typically your Final Four is reserved for, you know, four people that you can all legitimately see winning and going into the WrestleMania. Well, certainly Mr. Perfect wasn't one of those people, but just the idea that they... for some reason decided to put this guy making his return to the company on this night in that position was strange but awesome. And the fact that, you know, Perfect seemed to be in shape and, you know, was still able to execute all the spots, I think just like really helped matters, because I guess I didn't really see Godfather in this role, but Perfect seemed like a good fit.
Yeah. I was going to just give that one to you. He came out, and as I said, all these guys selling for him. It was a great nostalgia moment. Kurt Angle was after him at 26th. 27th was The Big Show. 28th, Kane, who squared off with Show, and it ended with a scoop slam, sending Big Show out. And then a stunner is delivered to Kane, and Angle eliminates Kane with an angle slam, sending Kane to the floor. Number 29 was Rob Van Dam, who hits a frog splash to Angle, a rolling thunder to Austin, and then turns into a pedigree. And RVD was murdered, just laid dead in the ring from this pedigree. And then the 30th entrant was Booker T, who immediately tosses the prone RVD out. Remember, this is 2002, when RVD had only come in July, and this was still a pretty... This was still at a time where I think the jury was out on whether RVD was going to be a top guy. And my God, he couldn't have looked worse, I think, in this Rumble. Just in and out pretty well. Got the Ziggler treatment that we saw this past Sunday. And they explained that RVD just simply never recovered from that pedigree. And this would also be the first time Hunter and RVD ever interacted in a match. Booker does a spin-a-rooney, and Austin just stuns him, and he's out from the stunner. Just... hilarious elimination. So we're down to Austin, Hunter, Angle, and Perfect. Angle hits a bunch of belly-to-back suplexes to Austin. Austin tries to eliminate Mr. Perfect, but Angle comes from behind and dumps out Austin. So Mr. Perfect would outlast Steve Austin in the Rumble. Austin then goes after Perfect, but Angle sends Austin into the steps. Austin comes back with a chair, laying out Kurt and Mr. Perfect, and then delivers another chair shot to Triple H, and Austin is on his way to the back. There was a perfect plex to Angle. He then snapped the neck. Crowd loved the perfect plex spot, as they did when Perfect was up against the ropes, spits out his gum in mid-struggle, and hits it. Just great. And then Hunter clotheslines Perfect out, so we're down to Hunter and Angle. There's a back body drop. Angle does the cliche spot where you back body drop him and turn your back and celebrate. Hunter is still in, drives Angle's face into his knee, and clotheslines Angle out of the match and wins the Rumble. 69 minutes and 22 seconds, the longest Rumble in Rumble history.
That's interesting that it took so long.
Longer than the 40-man Rumble.
Well, they must have spaced out the entrances way more than 2 minutes.
Yeah, it's typically 90 seconds, but it's never too consistent. Like, they'll fluctuate the time a lot, and you had maybe a bit more time after the 30th entrant this year. But, yeah, a lengthy one, but a very good Rumble. A lot of different creative spots. Triple H was the focus guy for this particular year, and a big call from Jim Ross to end the show as Hunter celebrates. And this show did very well. 680,000 buys on pay-per-view that year, which was up from the prior year, even though popularity slightly down in 2002 than it was from 2001. And I thought it was a very good pay-per-view overall.
I thought a good show, in particular the Rumble. I thought the last 50 minutes were great. I thought all the stuff with Taker was great in the middle. And, you know, I can't say I was as ecstatic about the rest of the card. I thought it was a fine card, but just nothing that really stood out. If anything, I'll say that Flair-Vince match probably was my second favorite match outside of the Rumble. So I give the show a 7 out of 10.
I will go 8 out of 10. A good consistent show at the time. The biggest story at this particular point was the news that they had signed Hogan, Hall, and Nash, and the very next night on Raw, Vince would come out and he would announce that he is going to kill his creation, inject this company with poison, and then it would be on SmackDown where he would do the infamous promo in the mirror and flip the chair around, revealing the NWO letters, which had to have been spelt backwards for the reflection. So everyone thought the One Warrior Nation was coming.
What do you think about the NWO coming in?
At the time, I thought it was a horrible idea.
Oh, really?
I understood Hogan coming because there were matches to be made there. Hall and Nash, I saw no upside to. I didn't think there were going to be any big matches to make. I thought there was a main event style that the fans had come up through over the past 2 to 3 years that Hall and Nash could never hang at. Hogan couldn't either, but Hogan, you could understand why you would make that sacrifice. I just didn't see the need to bring in Hall and Nash at this point. I didn't. And, you know, history really shows. I mean, those two didn't make a whole lot of difference. It was Hogan that came in and had the Rock match, and you did a number of big matches with Hogan. What did you think at the time? A year removed from WCW being gone.
Yeah, I think I largely felt the same. You know, I think, you know, having followed WCW at the time, at least for a little bit, you understood the limitations of these three men, at least in ring,
and what issues they would present backstage. Yep. I mean, these guys were, as described on TV, they were poison, and of course they would be in a different environment. But lots of people were. I mean, they infamously did a big meeting where a lot of the executives were asked about the thoughts of bringing these in, and a lot of them didn't want them to come in.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, rather than ask our present-day thoughts, I think it's always nice to go back and see what people thought at the time. And don't we have some historical archival footage?
Well, we do, eh? Because, as I've talked about on some past shows, there are a number of editions of The Law that I have saved on cassette from this past time period, and the Royal Rumble.
This was before you worked at The Law.
This was about a year and a half before I started working at The Law. I was just a listener at the time. And did have the 02 Rumble, so went back thanks to the help of Wei Ting's Walkman. It's in working order. Great Walkman, by the way. Thanks. Do you still listen to music on it?
No, not so much.
No, it's just an antique now?
I guess.
Well, we are going to go back, and first up, we are going to hear from the hosts from that night, Dan Lavransky and Jason Agnew. And that night, they were not joined by Dave Meltzer, because at that point, this was when The Law had a Saturday and Sunday show, and they had started using Brian Alvarez on Sunday nights. So we're going to hear from those three the night of the Royal Rumble with their immediate thoughts coming off of this show of what they thought of the Royal Rumble.
Live audio wrestling, talking professional wrestling until 1 a.m. Jay, I would have to say we're virtually gushing over the Royal Rumble pay-per-view.
It was a good one.
It was, absolutely.
I haven't seen a pay-per-view like that since... Wow. Since when?
Since WOW? Since the WOW pay-per-view?
Well, that had highlights of its very own. Has some redeeming qualities.
Well, that's
like
very,
an Ed
very
Wood
funny.
Thing going for WOW.
Oh, that's for sure. We're going to take more of your phone calls and emails as well, but right now we're going to take a trip over to the other side of the country and talk to Brian Alvarez, the editor of the Figure Four Weekly, get his thoughts on the Royal Rumble. Brian, how you doing tonight?
Pretty good.
So... Well, first up, here we don't do thumbs up, thumbs down. It's either clean finish or running. What would you pick for tonight?
I'd call it a clean finish.
It was definitely a good pay-per-view, was it not?
Oh, yeah, it was a good show.
So, what's that? Let me get some of your thoughts on the booking. How about the booking in the Flair versus McMahon match? Were you surprised? Because I think a lot of us thought McMahon was just going to go out there and squash Flair.
I think as far as, like, looking at the show, I kind of figured that Jericho was going to win and that Hunter was going to win. But in 100 million years, I would never, ever have guessed that Flair was going to beat Vince with the Figure Four in the middle, clean. And Vince did it. And I mean, I didn't think that Vince was going to go out there and squash him. But as soon as like they added the street fight stipulation, I thought, okay,
mm-hmm.
someone's coming in, someone's going to hit Flair with something, and Vince is going to beat him. But they didn't do it.
Yeah.
Shocked.
It was kind of weird that they put the street fight stip on because really they did very little outside the ring.
I think it was a good thing to do because I think that Vince might have been a little scared that they kind of may need something else, like hitting each other with stuff outside the ring. And I think it just turned out that the stuff they did in the ring, the wrestling was good enough that they really didn't need everything else. But I think that, you know, just in case they'd have been doing something in the ring and the crowd would have really started to die, they would have this, you know, the plunder to go to. But they didn't need it, and it was a real surprise.
Mm-hmm. Now, are you surprised, too, that they... A lot of the things about this pay-per-view that surprised me, Brian, is they actually made the right booking decisions to carry on. Because, I mean, to make that angle work, if they're going to do the split, Flair had to win that match.
Yeah, I think that if they would have done the split tomorrow, I think that they would have had to do, like, a disputed finish. And I think if they're going to do the split after WrestleMania, I really don't think it mattered who won here. In fact, I think they could have done, like, Vince going over here and then Flair the next show, and then have, like, the tiebreaker at WrestleMania, and then they would do the split finish, and then they could split it up from there afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess they could do it with, you know, they do another match next month, and Vince gets his win, and then they have the blow-off match at WrestleMania. But, I mean, as far as all the booking on the show, I think for the most part it was all, you know, really good.
Mm-hmm. So I guess that kind of puts us, what do we expect to see tomorrow night? First off, have you heard anything new on the Hogan-Nash Hall front?
No, nothing.
Okay, no. I don't suspect to see them tomorrow night.
No, I don't think so.
So where can we expect things to go? You don't think the split's going to take place until WrestleMania? Where do you see things going tomorrow night?
I don't think the split's going to happen tomorrow. I mean, as much as I think that the Flair-Vince finish was great, there was something about the fact that Vince put him over clean in the middle that makes me really worry about the future of Ric Flair tomorrow.
Yeah, so you think the feud's not done then?
Oh, I'm sure it's not done. And mm-hmm. I think something... I don't know if Vince will beat him tomorrow in, where are they, Charlotte, or where the hell are they?
Greensville.
Greensboro.
Greensville, yeah.
I don't know if Vince is going to beat him in his hometown, because that's kind of like Flair's calling card.
That's
the last,
right.
Decade. Beat in his hometown, but that is tomorrow, so I think something's probably going to happen there. And as far as, like, long term, I don't even know as far as, like, looking at who is eliminating who tonight, where they're going to go, you know, for WrestleMania. I figure they'll probably do Hunter and Jericho on top, and then I guess probably the rest of the... You know, big matches depend on when they get Hogan, Hall, and Nash in.
Mm-hmm. So you're not expecting Jericho to drop? Because I still have a bad feeling that Jericho is going to drop the belt to Austin at the next pay-per-view.
I don't think he would drop it. I think if he dropped it to anybody, it wouldn't be Austin. I don't think it's going to be Austin and Hunter. And, I mean, as of today, I really think they're going to go with Jericho and Hunter.
Wow, that would be something. If they really follow through on that, it actually might help. Because did you notice, Brian, Jericho still has that stigma attached to him of not being one of the top guys. He didn't get the pop you'd expect coming out as champion.
Well, it's the way that they've booked him. And they did a better job tonight in that the way that he won was not the direct result of somebody running in, which it usually is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he did cheat. He used the exposed buckle, and he put his feet on the ropes and everything like that. But it was cleaner than I thought it was going to be. So I think that and the fact that he can go on TV tomorrow and cut the promo and say, you know, everyone thought it was a joke and I did it again. You beat Rock for the fifth time, blah, blah, blah. I think, you know, enough little wins are going to help. The one thing I think they need to do with Jericho, if he's not going to beat the top guys clean, which obviously he's not going to do, he does not need to be laying down for Farouk.
Yeah.
On TV matches.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Like
absolutely.
That.
Yeah, absolutely. And what about what they did with Maven? It seems to be an interesting thing. He didn't get actually thrown over the top rope. He did eliminate Undertaker. He got the crap beat out of him. Where do you think that... You think that we'll even see anything? Will they follow up on this, or will this just be another trivia note?
I think that it's like one of those great WWF moments, because a lot of the people that have called here and the people that I was watching with, everybody just went crazy when Maven eliminated the guy.
Right.
But it wasn't like, it was one of those jobs where the guy doesn't put him over, because Undertaker just killed him afterwards.
Exactly.
It was like a total fluke.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it was a great moment, but I don't think it really did anything for Maven. And, you know, the only thing that I can really see them doing, which I think would be stupid, but they could do it, is say, this guy really was not eliminated, so it's going to be him versus Hunter on Raw.
Right.
And, you know, Hunter just kills him or whatever. But, I mean, for just a moment, it was cool. But as far as, like, really elevating Maven, I don't think anybody should fool themselves into thinking that's what they did, because they didn't.
Right, right. I think another really cool moment, a lot of the responses we're getting here, is the return of Curt Hennig. Mr. Perfect, a lot of the calls we've taken so far in the first hour, really everybody happy to see him back. Now, as we understand, Brian, this is only a one-shot deal, but wouldn't a Perfect Angle feud work quite well?
Well, actually, Hennig was telling people last week that he was coming in, like, this was going to be, like, more than a one-shot deal.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, just the fact that they brought him in when they did, near the end, and he was, like, one of the last three, makes me think that this isn't just a one-shot deal, and they'll probably, I don't know if they'll sign for, like, a long-term deal or something, but maybe, you know, have him do a program with Angle, because I think it, I mean, he was in good shape,
mm-hmm.
Didn't look embarrassing, nothing like that, and I think they could do something with him.
Right, yeah, and the only thing, because they really looked like they were teasing an Angle with him and Angle, but it would have been so much better if Angle had eliminated Perfect rather than Triple H throwing him over the top rope.
Yeah, they could have done something there, but, you know. I mean, the one thing, it's just, the only downside to it is he's one of those older guys that's going to come in, and if they bring him in and give him a, you know, a match with Angle or a program with Angle, he's jumping right past a lot of young guys like
True.
Edge. And to think that they're doing that now when they wouldn't do that for the Invasion, it's just one of those ironies. It's like, I just don't get it, but...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Brian, that brings up a good...
It's better than the Boss Man.
Yeah, anything's better than the Boss Man, for sure. That brings up a really interesting point, too, is like, after seeing this pay-per-view so well laid out, stuff building off what came before it and building for tomorrow, I still have this bad feel that they could screw it all up so quickly. Like, or is this really, like, part of a turnaround, finally?
I don't think that, like, one show you can call a turnaround, but, I mean, it's so weird because it's one show that's booked really well in the middle of all this horrible booking.
Yeah.
Like, Hunter's coming back and wrestling his first match back on SmackDown.
Oh, terrible idea.
And all this horrible, terrible booking. And it's like, now the only thing that surprises me about the WWF is when they do something right. And that's what they did on this show.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it's really a turnaround or what they're going to do, but I'm just worried about Flair.
Yeah.
All I got to say.
No, a very young-sounding group of men.
What a blast from the past.
Yeah.
That was 13 years ago.
Oh, amazing.
So, yeah, the audio, it's still in decent quality.
Yeah. Was that all?
Well, there are also some callers.
Oh, yeah?
On the Lost Sunday night.
Oh, I loved hearing from callers at the time.
I don't know. I don't know if we really want to hear from
yeah,
callers.
I definitely want to hear from callers. I mean, especially, you know... callers that I wonder if they hurt themselves today, what they would think, you know?
Huh. Well, unfortunately, this call, it was at the start of Side B, so I didn't get to hear the name of the caller.
Oh, okay. Well, okay. Well, just I'm sure.
So
that,
this starts mid call.
Yeah, this is just some random caller. I'm just curious to hear some random callers.
Well, I was really taken aback by this particular reaction to the NWO coming back. I mean. A little kid could use a little more bass in his voice, I think. But
well, you don't have to be mean to some anonymous
guy. Probably
not
listening.
You probably don't even know this guy.
Well, I thought brought up some key points, but
let's just hear it.
Well, let's hear from this youngster.
Seems like all the callers tonight they're just going about, you know, three count horsemen NWO. I'm just
for me personally as a wrestling fan, I found my, like, it's just going back to the past. I find wrestling, the part I liked about it, you know, from 98, 99, was it was about evolution, you know.
Something new.
Things, like, this is the same. WWF, in my opinion, has become everything they poked fun of during that whole Attitude era. The Attitude, in my opinion, is gone.
Mm-hmm.
This was the same company that, what was 6 years ago, was making fun of the Huckster and Nacho Man, and now this is the guy who they're going to be around. Like,
well, you know, I mean, nothing's ever a given in professional wrestling, and I've seen this thing happen so many times in the past.
True.
They'll ridicule a guy, and then all of a sudden, you know, a few months later, there he is. I mean, Vince, even in the past, used to bring guys in and then ridicule them. He brought in Harley Race, and when he brought in Dusty Rhodes, he made fun of both of those guys' great careers, man, pretty well turned them into jokes. So, I mean, I'm not too surprised by that point. The part that bothers me is that I don't know why you want to recycle old stuff.
Yeah, it's
come up with new stuff. Why don't, to me, I don't think it should be associated with the NWO at all. It should be just Vince went out to get more help to combat Flair.
Yeah, wrestling, I just find wrestling needs a new angle, a new something to base itself around. Like, Vince seems to be putting all his money into this big nostalgia pop. Like, we've seen from Heroes of Wrestling and, you know, the WWA pay-per-view, you can't base something around a nostalgia pop. And that's basically what Vince is doing right now, hoping that what they did 5-6 years ago is going to help now. And I think wrestling fans, just personally from my friends, I'm like 17, they just, wrestling is just 1999. It's not something really cool anymore.
Right.
It's something that's, it's not part of that attitude.
Well,
that was,
you know,
it was very, you know, when you'd watch Raw 4 years ago, you know, you never knew what you were going to see.
Yeah.
Now it's become very, very predictable.
Yeah, no, that's a great point that you bring up, John. It's because, and think of it, how can Vince, his product be seen as hip and cool when, A, he's the leader, he's in his late 50s, the guys that he's bringing in are all in their late 40s, and they're like, you know, really has-beens when it comes
to
wrestling.
5 years ago, would you ever have imagined people like Hurricane Helms are on Raw? Like, it's just become, you know, Vince is going back to the whole insulting your intelligence thing.
Wow.
Wrestling was all about reality back then and more realistic characters, and now it seems it's just, it's gone back to that.
You think so?
Cartoonish.
Yeah.
Type stuff.
Yeah, it still seems to be pretty. I understand where you're coming from. You're right. There was that big switch where Vince did try to make it like a realistic adult drama,
right,
rather than the cartoon characters of our youth. But I think he still tries to keep it fairly realistic like that. But
to
again,
a degree, but yeah, I find a lot of the comedy lately is just very, you know, like everything, all the comedy, the backstage skits, I just found are really, really, you know, aimed at a very young audience.
Well, let me put it this way then: are you the type that wants to see some of the more trashy stuff come back, like Undertaker?
I'm not a fan of the trashy stuff. But in that same case, I'm not a fan of, you know, seeing like Hurricane Helms going around. Like, it's funny and all, but it's not something that, you know, I want to be watching with all my friends. You know, it's not something that's very entertaining.
Right.
I know. I wouldn't. I kind of am like right in the middle there, sort of.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot for your call, John.
Okay, thanks a lot, guys.
Whoa.
Interesting.
So, again.
Interesting. That was kind of the flavor of the day when it came to the NWO. Again, whoever that was, interesting to go back in time. And
a little too critical. I think his older self would probably tell him, you know, hey, chill out a little.
Yeah. Hopefully he would grow into a better, a bit more confidence.
Public speaker?
Yeah, probably went nowhere, though. I wonder if he's a wrestling follower any longer.
I don't know.
Well, we don't have any more audio to get to, but we do have some text to discuss. Maybe one of these people will
listen again.
That young gentleman.
Yeah. Maybe somebody will pull this clip 13 years from now.
Yes, that random 17-year-old. Why don't you start us off?
Go to Matt in suburban Detroit. Don't worry, John. I'm more positive this week than I was last. Due to the death, William Regal didn't get a shot at the WWE title, which, in my opinion, he should have. Regal's power of the punch match with technical ability made Edge look so good as a face. You knew that when Edge got his revenge, it should be a shot straight to the top. Flair vs. McMahon was good for a match against Vince. Rock vs. Jericho was a great match. Just shows how much psychology is missing today. Rumble is very good. Four huge returns, Goldust, Godfather, Val Venus, and Mr. Perfect. Unfortunately, Val and Godfather couldn't get the RTC stench off of them. But it's good to be Godfather. Vince still brings him back.
Okay, we go to Andrew McDonald. I'm currently watching the Rumble now, and one issue I have during some Rumbles is how they can be structured. 2002 was a bad example of a Rumble with a bunch of geeks who fight for nothing, then a real star comes in, the ring is cleared, and eventually the geeks come back in the ring until a real star comes back. I know the Rumble sometimes draws its numbers where the top guys usually get bigger numbers, but this year it seemed lazily put together, except for a few spots. My favorite part of the Rumble was the infamous Undertaker elimination by Maven, which is still pretty well remembered. One issue I had while watching it on the network, though, was not getting to hear Maven's music, despite Edge and Undertaker having their themes intact. WWE should at least give thanks to you guys, because one reason I keep the network is to watch shows for your podcast. 5 out of 10 show, with the undercard being okay, and the Rumble being subpar. Maybe we should be getting some back end of these subscriptions.
Ronaldo from Milan, Italy. It's a beautiful day. Triple H wins the Rumble and goes on to win the main event of one of the least remembered main event matches in WrestleMania history. Ric Flair shines in one last time against Vinnie Mac. The Rumble was good and typical of the Attitude Era. Mr. Perfect Kurt Hennig gets the last laugh as he shows the entire roster how it's done. Very good show.
We go to Bill from Hamilton. Things look quite promising for the WWE after the Invasion debacle ended. Austin was a face again. Jericho was champion. Flair was with the company. The Rock was still in top form, and I have to admit, I was pretty psyched for Hunter's return. However, this would also be the beginning of the Attitude Era hangover. Not to mention the effects of the Invasion were still lingering, considering how Booker and RVD were booked in the Rumble. It was clear the WWE was reluctant to do anything with them, still seeing them as the other guys. I remember reading the list of Rumble entrants a week before the show. When I saw Maven's name, I thought the website had misspelled Raven. I completely forgot who this guy was, even though I knew about Tough Enough. And of course, this guy I barely remembered, helping deliver the most jaw-dropping moment in Rumble history. I remember my cousins and I just being dumbfounded. Say what you will about Hunter in this era, but he had to go over here. It was perfectly logical booking, but of course it would end up being too much effort for the WWE to put Jericho at his level during the WrestleMania build-up. Instead, they just caused the casual fan to think they were building up to Hunter versus Stephanie. Despite the fallout from this show as a standalone show, it's excellent. The undercard was fun and entertaining. Jericho versus Rock was an underrated feud with great chemistry from both parties. 8 Hurricane Choke Slams out of 10.
Dwayne from Ireland, he says the Rumble match itself was certainly one of the better efforts, with the shock of Maven. The fun spot where Hurricane tried to choke slam Austin and Hunter, and Mr. Perfect taking the time to spit out his gum despite being worked over by Austin and Hunter sticking out.
James in Wichita, Kansas. I watched this show with my 8-year-old daughter, and she was shocked and appalled when Taz put his hands on Stacy Keibler. Everybody hates the PG era, but a man fighting a woman should be shocking. I'm sure in 2002, that was the norm in WWE. Best match of the night for me was Vince and Ric Flair because I'm a glutton for punishment. The Rumble was the Rumble. Great as always. I give the show 6 beautiful day promos out of 10.
We go to Brad from Whitby, who says, it's Saturday night and I've just seen Vince McMahon make his way to the ring. I paused my video, loaded up my Scott Putski award thread, and have officially added Vince as the winner for the show.
Well,
sorry, John and Way, if I have overstepped my bounds, but I have a feeling you will be agreeing with me. Well, we did not. I'm sorry.
It was a tough year.
Guys, check the request thread for your next show. It has grown quite a bit since last week.
Okay, we go to Randy in Australia. I generally only watch the shows that you're reviewing when I remember them being good. Watching this show for the first time in 10 years, I have no idea what I thought was good about it. I hated Vince versus Flair. The heat spot went for too long, which ruined the match. Ric Flair is the greatest wrestler of all time. Am I supposed to believe Vinnie Mac could beat him up like that for a good 5 to 6 minutes? Yes, he's old, but so's Vince. I love both Jericho and Rock during this period, but for all the chemistry they had together, this match sucked, was overbooked, and in hindsight, it was typical of how pointless the Jericho reign was because the company never got behind him. The Rumble is my favorite event of the year, but I tend to find that the matches rarely age well. When it's current, I can tolerate all the mid-carders because for a lot of them, we still have hope as to what they might become, but to watch the matches 12 years on is depressing because very few of these mid-carders become anything at all. Is it 3 out of 10? Not a fan.
Okay, we go to Michael from New York. This was one of my favorite Rumbles ever, with Rock versus Jericho being an outstanding title match, and the Rumble holding my attention from start to finish. The Rumble match was also had one of the best eliminations of all time with Maven and Taker. Unfortunately, that never amounted to much, but it was cool nonetheless.
Okay, we go to John from Anchorage, Alaska. This Rumble was memorable for the Flair-Vince feud and the Natchez comeback, Watching this match, both co-owners would be bloodied like stuck pigs. Undertaker's elimination in the Rumble match by Maven would be a Kodak moment, which would later become cringeworthy with the unprotected chair shot to Maven's head. Mr. Perfect being in the Rumble match to fight the likes of Triple H and Stone Cold was unique to watch at the time. Triple H's comeback would be big during this time from his quad injury. I give this show 8 out of 10. Thanks for the calculation from Sunday night, Pollock.
Okay, we go to Jim from Phoenix, who says, this Rumble was booked so much better than 2015. Better surprises, changes of pace, better use of pops for mid and undercard wrestlers, better use of Kane in the Big Show, better at avoiding cluttering the ring at the end so there's room for new entrants to hit big spots. It wasn't perfect with the lackluster beginning until Taker came out, and the eliminated wrestlers coming back to interfere with no repercussions was just dumb as it was this year. It is 14 DDP's favorite number. He entered the same spot in 22 as he did in 2015. I enjoyed this Rumble so much more than 2015 that I didn't really notice that Triple H wasn't booked that strongly and even had a few heelish spots as opposed to coming in as a boring white meat babyface on his return.
And finally, Kai. I may not remember much from 2002, but I definitely remember Triple H returning in a blaze of glory and winning the Rumble, and it still excites me to this very day. The Vince Flair street fight was something to behold, and as much as I love Jericho as the Undisputed Champion, I can't help but realize that despite being the guy on the surface, deep down he was still just a background player for the much bigger stars. Also, his match with The Rock was pretty meh as well. 6 out of 10. And did you know that there are two instances where a Final Fantasy game sponsored a WWE pay-per-view? This show and Armageddon 2003 would be sponsored by Final Fantasy X2.
Did not know that. Thanks.
We need a Did You Know thread.
Okay.
Well, thank you for everybody's comments and feedback to this edition of the Royal Rumble. That's going to wrap up the show. Fun.
Wrap it up.
Recap of the 2002 Royal Rumble. Next week on the show, Wei Ting has some wrestling he would like to go back and watch.
Yeah. You know what? We actually had chosen something else, but you know, I feel bad if we didn't go to the request thread. So let me look at the request thread, which you can find at lawradio.proboards.com, and see what some of you have suggested. I'm reading it.
Very you, of nice. Course, can go to the pro wrestling section of the Law Radio message board and post your requests that we will try and get to as often as we can. There are obviously going to be a lot of requests.
Somebody requested Frankenhooker.
Oh.
Which I don't know if will be that relevant. I mean, some of these have nothing to do with wrestling. A game of magic cards between John and Wei.
Yeah.
Somebody wants to review that. Come on, be serious here. And be creative. And you know what? If you can, give an explanation. Just looking at the time frame of some of these, I feel like the one that might be somewhat relevant to this review, actually, maybe this episode of Nitro from February 9th, 1998, featuring Goldberg taking on Steven Regal.
Oh, this is an infamous match where things fell apart rather quick between one Bill Goldberg and Lord Steven Regal.
Love it.
Okay, this is... Are you prepared? This is the 3-hour era of Nitro.
I guess I'll have to be.
Okay, well, this one's on way. So next week, what's the date again?
February 9, 1998.
Okay, the February 9th, 1998 edition of Monday Nitro will be reviewed next week on the show. This from the request thread, so no complaints. That and a whole lot more coming up this week. We've got Bauer and Pollock later today. On Thursday, What's Next will be up with Jason Agnew and Braden Harrington.
Oh, nothing. Sorry.
Oh.
I was going to say, never mind.
Okay. And on Friday, perhaps a look at SmackDown. That is a TBA at this point.
Sure.
Are you going to be watching SmackDown?
I might.
You might. Okay. So it might be Wei with me. It might be somebody else. We'll find out. Because SmackDown may be more important than most weeks this particular week, and I've had many people ask. So Friday's a rather quiet day for me, so why the fuck not? So that is all up there. Review of Raw is up for Monday night, including the results of the Review Away Royal Rumble Pool, which there was a controversy way, but not a big one. We did have an incorrect list of Bubba Ray being the first one out. It was The Miz. It has been recalculated. And Sam Venus, a longtime fan of Review Away, a man who donated tickets to WrestleMania for a lucky listener back in 2013,
is still our winner with 40 points. It did come down to a tiebreaker. He still won the tiebreaker. So Sam Venus, the undisputed Review Away Royal Rumble Pool winner for 2015.
Yeah, and for more details on the calculations, please visit lawradio.proboards.com.
Yes.
Where Chris Angler has filled out his
explanation. We did not make it easy for Mr. Angler this year. So a big thank you once again to Chris Angler for all his work with maintaining the pool. The Law's up from Sunday. Also, Chris Charlton has a great interview with Rocky Romero up on the site, formerly of the Forever Hooligans. He will discuss Alex Kozlov taking a sabbatical from wrestling, what is next for him in New Japan. Lots of great stuff. So much great audio to download, so go check that out. iTunes, Stitcher, the Fight Network app, liveaudiowrestling.com, and we'll be back next week chatting Nitro 1998.
Mr. Perfect is the highlight.
Look at this! Look at this, man! This is not my doing, but I'm loving it. Everybody wants to talk about Mr. Perfect. Who would have thought?
I was watching it in a bar, and the top three pops of the whole night was when Henning came out, he got a pop. And then when he hit the perfect flex, he got a pop.
Wow!
And when he almost got thrown out, and then he somehow managed to stay back in.
Right.
That got a huge pop, too.
Wow. It's unbelievable how much, when it is an older guy that was a talented guy, and we haven't seen him for a long time. I mean, at one time, a perfect was out for good. Henning had that policy with Lloyd's of London over his injury, and he was out for good there. So, I mean, to see him come back and actually be in the ring and actually be competitive, because I figured he'd show up midway, be around for a bit, and then get tossed
like
out.
A honky-tonk man thing from last year.
Right, right, and yeah. That's not what they did.